Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Welcome into the RotoWire NFL podcast brought to you by our friends over at WinBet. I am your host, John McCackney, joined as always by Mario Puig. We got a lot to get to today. We're going to dive into some latest news and rumors from around the league, the latest in the Julio Jones saga, of course, and then keeping it in the saga realm. Also going to be talking a little bit of Aaron Rodgers and Packers before getting into some of Mario's most recent best ball drafts over on Underdog, trying to pick his brain about early strategy at this stage, players he's targeting at their current ADPs, players he's fading. And then we'll use that as a bit of a jumping off point to talk about some early receiver strategy. But first off, Mario, how you doing on this fine Thursday heading into Memorial Day?
It's fine. It got really cold for some reason overnight, and I never check the weather before I take my dog outside in the morning. So I went out there a bit underdressed, been awake for a long time as a result of that. And yeah, I'm ready to talk defensively about my Trevor Lawrence shares in best ball leagues as everyone's talking about Taysom Tebow or whatever.
Oh gosh, right. Yeah, that whole thing. But yes, can confirm it did get really cold here.
I'm not freaking out. I'm not having any sort of issues psychologically with it. I'm doing good.
No, of course not. Never. But before we get there, let's start off elsewhere in the AFC South, where AJ Brown is putting on the media blitz via his Instagram, really pushing hard, recruiting hard to see if, you know, Julio Jones may be someone that the Titans can acquire from the Falcons. Obviously, there was the drama earlier this week with the Shannon Sharp phone call and all that on that Fox Sports show. But regardless, do you think that Julio Jones is definitely going to be traded? And what have you made of AJ Brown's pitch in particular, while also denying that Julio would get number 11 if he did link up with the Titans?
Yeah, I don't know what to make of that. I mean, AJ Brown may or may not have some influence with Vrabel, who I assume does most of the personnel decisions for the Titans. I don't know how much. I'm guessing not that much, but maybe they were just in on it anyway. Maybe this is like a little bit extra nudge that might change their calculation a little bit. But either way, I guess there's good reason at this point to consider the Titans one of the favorites to get him, which I'm skeptical it would help anything of theirs. But I guess two teams who are kind of bad at making personnel come up with scenarios like that where it's not good for either side. And doesn't mean they won't do it just because it doesn't really make that much sense necessarily. I mean, the Falcons especially, I mean, you know, they luck out into trading Mohamed Sanu for a second rounder, and then they trade that for Hayden Hurst, who they almost immediately decide they don't actually want. Obviously, Tennessee just cutting Adoree Jackson, and then he immediately signs a $13 million annually contract. So it's like, ooh, could we have gotten a fourth for him? Yeah, probably. Best not to think about that. These guys might come up with something ridiculous, but I'd like to see, I guess, Julio in someplace more like Kansas City, where if he wants to leave Atlanta to win, I'd rather not see him go to a team that clearly will not.
Right. So the Titans, they don't quite make
or at least I'm low on them. Yeah.
No, that's fair. I think if you were to kind of re-rack all the teams that made the postseason a year ago and rank their chances of making it back this year, I think the Titans would be relatively low on that list. So I'm with you there. I hadn't even really considered the Chiefs as a potential landing spot, but that would just be, you know, then we're like really reaching super team status when it comes to the Chiefs. That would be absurd. I've considered that that the Chargers, I think, would be a really interesting landing spot for Julio Jones that would, you know, boost his fantasy value and you know, kind of raise the tide for everybody, and, you know, Justin Herbert included.
Yeah, maybe. I guess I don't have any firm thought on whether it would be an upgrade or a downgrade or a lateral move if he were to go there, but it would certainly help Justin Herbert avoid, you know, any regression that we might fear from his rookie year numbers.
Right, exactly. So, the tons of teams apparently are interested in Julio, and we'll see how this continues to shake out. But let's move on over to Green Bay. What's the latest? What have you kind of digested from everything that's coming out this week out of Lambeau? You know, be it Aaron Rodgers' appearance on Kenny Mayne's last SportsCenter, or you know, anything else that's on your mind when it comes to Rodgers and the state of the Packers.
Well, I guess pretty much Rodgers and all the receivers. I don't know what's going on with the tight ends or any other particular group of players on the team, but it was all of Davante Adams, Lazard, Valdez Scantling, Equanimeous, and Devin Funchess all apparently weren't at the OTAs or whatever. And particularly a guy like Funchess, there's got to be a political significance behind that, because he's not in a position to feel like his roster spot is safe. Like, he's not in a position to feel like, I don't even need OTAs. They can't get rid of me. He already took a pay cut, you know, so they can get rid of him. And it's almost as if he was placing a bet that, I don't know, Rodgers is going to get what he wants and get that GM fired. I don't know. Because, like, what happens if they trade Rodgers? Then his you know, show of allegiance to Rodgers certainly doesn't get him anything with the new remaining team. They'll cut him that much faster if they trade Rodgers. So he apparently, I don't know, maybe it was it for another reason. Maybe it was all, you know, incidental, separate reasons, totally aside from Rodgers' whole deal. But it kind of looked like a show of solidarity with him, which it's not what you want to see if you're the GM. Like, it's going into a very weird territory that I can't think of in the NFL, you know, just basically dictating the front office, which I think it's fine. I think Rodgers is basically cool for it, because he's just playing with the actual leverage that he has. And the GM did bet on Rodgers falling off the last 2 years, and then, you know, denied it the whole time, saying like, oh no, we just thought it'd be a good idea to trade up for Love. We're fully committed to Rodgers. That's why we're not using this first round pick to help him, and we're not going to use any of the other ones probably. It's because we're totally committed to Rodgers. And so it's, I don't know, I get it in his position being like, well, if you want to just lie like that, then I can do that too. And I can do the same thing as you, where I say I'm not being, you know, hostile or like speculating against your interests or whatever, and then just do it anyway. Cause like, that's all the Packers are doing. And it's, the GM, just should have been more straightforward about it. Shouldn't have done it, et cetera. So, we'll see. I have no idea where I have no inside knowledge of it, obviously, and I don't have any idea what everybody's thinking in it, but I don't really see how the Packers have any leverage here other than to trade Rodgers for whatever it is that they might get on the market, even if it's not as much as what they want. But to this point, they've used the condition of not getting what they want as a reason to not trade him. And like, that's kind of as if they think they have leverage that they just don't. It's like, you can hold out and hope for a better market, but not if the player just leaves. Like, if he just retires, like, you don't actually have any sort of recourse here. Like, you're acting as if you do. So it's pretty explosive looking situation to me. I guess if I guess you see it as like a three three possibility outcome of like either the GM gets fired and Rodgers comes back, or the Broncos or somebody, I guess I gotta say the Broncos trade for Rodgers for whatever the Packers are willing to accept, or the Packers play hardball too long and Rodgers just retires.
Yeah. So that's, those are three pretty interesting outcomes. And obviously, you know, that there's going to be some uncomfortable stuff either way it goes. And I kind of want to just explore that that first possibility that you mentioned, and maybe just kind of power rank the likelihood in your mind of those three things happening, starting off with the Packers potentially parting ways with Gutekunst to kind of curry the favor of Aaron Rodgers. Do you think that's likely? I mean, I'm trying to rack my brain for regime changes where they wait until, or a team will wait until after the draft and then fire their GM. I think the Texans are the only ones that I can think of in recent memory that did that. And I don't know if you want to be in the same boat as the Texans as far as your decision-making is concerned.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it is possible that Rodgers starts with the demand of fire the GM and maybe is willing to negotiate to a point less than that of, okay, you don't fire him, but we have some sort of like legally binding language that he does have to consult with me or something, or you know, I'll back off my demand to fire the GM if you trade for Julio and give me $15 million or something. I don't know. So whatever he might feel like he can extract from them. But it doesn't really feel possible to me that they'll fire the GM because, you know, the whole point of owning and running an NFL team, and I know the Packers don't have a conventional owner, but they do have a power structure, and everybody in that power structure has the same incentives to preserve and accumulate and consolidate their power, regardless of, you know, the technical status of how it's owned. And in your position of a GM or whatever management position, it's like the whole point of you being there is to exert that power. It's like you're not actually interested in having a co-op here and sharing the spoils equally with everybody on a democratic basis. Like, you're here to preserve your authority, and anything that threatens it, you know, conceding a diminishing of your authority defeats the whole point. You might as well just resign instead, or just be like, I don't want to do this job anymore. So it would have to be somebody above the GM. And I don't know enough about the background politics of the Packers to know whether that's possible, but the GM is not going to fire himself. And anybody who has an investment in that GM's power structure is going to oppose this. So it's going to have to come from the outside. I don't know if there is such a thing.
Okay. All right. So that's a tricky little detail there when it comes specifically to the Packers and the way that organization is run. So do you feel like the trade then is a more likely scenario?
Again, it's like, it's this thing. The Watson deal with Houston was shaping up this way. It looked like Carson Wentz was going to shape up this way, but these teams, they have this ability to kind of have what I think is like this hypocritical position of like, I don't know how to explain it exactly, but they're like, we don't need to recognize like your value as a market asset. And like, we don't need to at the same, I don't know how to explain it, but it's something like where they basically reach a point that kind of like banks do when they need a bailout, where like they overextend their leverage. They get put in they get caught in a position. And in this case, it's with the salary cap and the cap penalties. And so they say, well, we don't want to trade this guy. No one's giving us a good enough deal for where it makes sense for us. And they have to accept like nothing that you can get at this point will so-called make sense for you. You screwed up and you don't have any leverage at this point. You just have to accept what you can get. And they say, well, we're just going to hold on to him anyway, because we're not getting a good enough offer. And it's like you did, and you just don't know it yet. And like, depending on how long the Packers play this out and how long a team like whatever the Broncos or whoever else might be interested is willing to play it out, that's how long it's going to go, because neither side will flinch until then. But what the Packers risk is the Broncos saying, fine, whatever, we're just going to go into this year. We've got Bridgewater and Locke, and we're moving ahead, and the store's closed. And the Packers will be like, wait, open back up. We didn't mean that. And it's going to just be too late. So they have to consider, you know, where that point in time is, and consider whether it's worth, you know, pressing their luck up to that point. But yeah, in the meantime, like giving up authority of personnel and like front office decisions, I don't really think that's possible. I think a trade or a retirement is more likely if Rodgers means that's the one thing that he'll accept. Because if there's a point he can negotiate from, then maybe he'll do it. But they have to entertain him somehow, and so far it seems like they don't really have any intention of it.
Okay, so again, this is a thorny issue, and again, you know, we we don't know exactly which direction, but you know, like you laid out, there are three likely scenarios as to how this all is going to unfold. Let's move on over. Let's talk about some of the recent best ball drafts that you've done over on Underdog. So starting things out, you know, kind of give us a background on how the best ball process over there works, maybe a little bit differently than some of the other like best ball sites like BB10s or over on DraftKings, that sort of thing, and what your approach has been through those couple of drafts.
So I was only doing my first two drafts on Underdog. I didn't know much about their whole deal, other than that, you know, people have been talking about them for a while. And I guess it's a lot like Draft before that site closed. It's kind of an appy looking interface, and I assume that they prefer that people use the app like Draft would always say. I always use computer like browser because I'm too old to do all these apps that everyone does. Also, I have a $20 Walmart phone that can't download apps, so I'm compelled to use the site. It works better than Draft did though, so it's less glitchy than before. Like I did two drafts, fast drafts with no problems. No like sticking buttons or, you know, things getting scrambled or weird connection issues. So it went smoothly. And the only thing that I, you know, at this point, even know, I haven't really investigated all the possibilities of the site. They have a bunch of formats that are different than what you see on some other sites. Like they have that sophomore and rookie only format, right?
Yeah.
Like little curious twists like that are there. And I might look at those eventually, but initially I went in just to see like the big best ball tournament that they have. And it's a pretty cool looking contest, I guess. Like big tournament contests for best ball is always interesting. It's an intriguing concept, and there's a big dollar figure behind this one. It's supposed to be like a million or whatever for the top prize. So with that kind of stakes, that definitely makes it a little more exciting than your $10 50-50 contest, although those contests of course have their place too, and you know, giving you some stability and some higher odds of return to offset where you take on bigger risks with tournaments like these. And it's a half point PPR rather than full point PPR like they have on the best ball tens. I think otherwise the only difference really is that there's no defenses, and or for that tournament anyway there wasn't any. So I think it was just quarterback, running back, three receiver, tight end, one flex. And I got to say, at least in that tournament draft format, the people drafting are, I think, quite a bit sharper than they tend to be in the average best ball 10 league, which makes sense. There's more money on the line. It's higher stakes. So one thing that occurred to me doing these drafts on best ball, these tournament drafts on Underdog, this tournament draft, they're really addictive because you go in with these certain plans or you develop these plans as the draft is going on, and they always get ruined. Like you always think you're close to pulling off some sort of stack or pairing or some other sort of strategic angle that you cook up as the draft goes along. And every time somebody undercuts you. So you get under the draft, you get out of the draft and you're tilting and you're like, I got to go in again. I almost had it. I'm going to get it this time. It's going to work. And so far it's like, it's not working. I don't know if I'm going to be able to figure out like a, you know, an adjusted strategy for it, but it seems like all you can really do is kind of take a lot of shots at it and hope that something falls your exact way. And in addition to the hope that you're even being right in the first place about whatever your strategy is. So it's pretty tough, and like the stakes keep you invested and it keeps sharper people flocking toward it, which makes you spend more compulsively on it. So it's definitely good. You definitely want to get sharper people going there so that you get, you know, people like us tilting when we're not getting the stacks that we got used to getting on places like best ball tens or whatever kind of like lower stake setting.
Yeah. And I know what you mean with like the fast draft element of it, where you finish up a draft and it's only been like 20 minutes for the entire thing to finish out. And you're like, well, you know, usually my drafts take at least like if, a regular one takes at least an hour. So, I mean, I got time. I definitely see like the whole dive back in element to it. And I'll have to explore it a little bit further. I won't I've only done, like we talked about a little bit earlier in the offseason, the rookies and second year player draft. And that was before the actual NFL draft happened. So I would be interested to see how that market has changed now that we know the landing spots of those rookies, that sort of thing. But yeah, good stuff. And so with that in mind, you know, how did you go in with some roster builds in mind, and which ones in particular, you know, had you cooked up that didn't quite get across the finish line as far as, you know, execution goes?
Yeah, so I like both of my teams enough. It's just kind of there were a few more snipes than I was ever used to in other sites. So definitely left more of a sting than usual. But when I look back on it, it's like I think the teams are pretty solid. And I'm guessing as much as I felt like I was getting sniped a lot, I imagine everybody else in the league feels like that too. Like I think everybody – I doubt there's – generally anyway, I doubt there's many people from any of these tournament drafts who leaves thinking – I just got everything I wanted there. Like it's probably everybody's feeling a bit stung pretty much every round. But what I went for with my first draft, which was the 12th spot, I had the 12th overall pick and took Eckler and Tyreek to start off there. I had no knowledge of like the ADP or just like the trends of the positional market trends in this format. So I didn't have any strategy other than like, hopefully don't screw up too bad. So I tried to sort of like give a little security at both running back and receiver by going with Eckler, who loses a little bit in the half point PPR, but I don't think that much. And at that point, anyway, he was kind of the best running back option in my opinion. So I went with him. I love his skill set. I think he's going to get a lot of usage. You know, I went to the RotoWire player page for him and clicked on the half point PPR scoring game log, and it was like, oh, that doesn't look so bad. I guess I'll go with that. And then Tyreek at receiver. You know, nothing's a lock there, but you get that kind of air yardage, that kind of target volume, yards after the catch ability in the Patrick Mahomes offense. Like starting with that, I figured couldn't have been too bad. And then I ended up getting Herbert later to sort of pair with Eckler, but I wasn't able to get Keenan Allen. I didn't go for Mike Williams. I actually went for Tyron Johnson in the last round, who I still am being a truther about. Like Josh Palmer is not
I respect
a good prospect.
That. Yeah.
So I got a little bit of a stack there, but I think I tried to get like, I took like CeeDee Lamb at the third round maybe. And I was hoping like, okay, maybe I'll get Amari Cooper at the fourth round pick. That's like three selections from now. And no, the guy who had the two picks in between me blew that up. And I was like, come on, man. Like, Cooper's not even that good. Why do you want him? So stuff like that was happening. And I took Jared Cook late, which I normally don't do that. But if I'm doing a Herbert roster, it's like, I guess it's then or never.
Sure. No, that makes sense. Going back to your first couple of picks, obviously I like Austin Eckler a lot too. I took him in the RotoWire full PPR draft that we talked about last week. But you mentioned him being like a safe option in it. I don't know if everyone would agree with that necessarily. So if you would just kind of expound a little bit on you know what like you know why Eckler in your mind is like worth that 12 with like some floor to him, because I don't feel like he gets perceived enough as being a safe player, especially, you know, maybe after the getting nicked up a bit last year.
Yeah, he has gotten nicked up a little bit, and he is a small running back. Like even though he's really well built, obviously, but by running back standards, being 5'9", 200, whatever he is, that's not very dense. It's like he's probably lighter than Clyde Edwards-Helaire, who's 2 inches shorter than him. So he's not a very dense runner, but what I think is beyond any dispute is that Eckler is probably one of the five most dangerous running backs from scrimmage in the whole NFL. And I'm not saying that he's as good or specifically as the top five running backs that someone might have in mind for fantasy, but those guys rank ahead of Eckler only because they get bigger workloads. And that's a meaningful limitation with Eckler, but also his price is accordingly lower than them. So I don't, it doesn't actually trouble me that he can't be a 20 carry running back. He's not priced like one, so it's fine. If I had to take him at the top four or top five, then we're talking a little different, because once you're in that price range, you need to score touchdowns like Alvin Kamara does, or else it's just not, the math isn't going to work. So, but anyway, back at like 11, 10, 12, stuff like that, I definitely think that as long as Herbert's on the field, Eckler will just kind of go along for some sort of ride just on that basis. And then on his own part, he's going to drive up the baseline because he's just one of the most dangerous players with the ball and without the ball. He's a great route runner. He can get open against corners running outside. He can do screen passes, whatever it is. And I think you have to consider him the favorite to lead that team with in yardage from scrimmage easily over Keenan Allen. And I just, if that's the case, it doesn't really like I get the risk, and I guess at some point you'll have to limit your exposure. Like if I did 10 of these drafts, I don't actually want 10 shares of Austin Ekeler, even if I consider them at a good market rate overall, because then you're just taking on too much injury risk, like with any player. But
sure,
because pretty much all running backs can get hurt, I can't really, unless I get my count to a share percentage to a certain point, I can't really start caring about that yet. But if you look at his game log from last year, clearly he is a workhorse player, even if a lot of it is as a target.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error. Get the Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Targets, because he was just getting tons of usage in that backfield after he got hurt and before he got hurt. So if Herbert keeps that offense scoring a lot of points and Ekeler is in the same role he's always been, his skill set and the circumstances just dictate that he's almost certain to produce, in my opinion. The only question is, like, is he top five or is he top, you know, 12 or sorry, top 10 at running back? But I don't think, injury risk aside, I don't think a third possibility really exists for me.
Okay. All right. That was a good explainer then on Austin Ekeler. Before we get on to the rest of your team here, we got a quick word from our sponsors. For our live stream friends, that'll be we're right back. We're here. That'll just be for the podcast portion of all this. But Mario, let's take a look at the rest of your roster construction with some of these players. So I guess round out the rest of that Justin Herbert stacked team, and then get into your Trevor Lawrence exposure as well.
Sorry, I'm going a little bit by memory, but I think, like I said, I had CeeDee Lamb. So that left me with Tyreek, CeeDee Lamb at receiver. I had Ekeler at running back one, and I don't think I took another running back for a little bit. I remember I took like David Johnson in the 10th round, which I'm not excited about that at all, but it was just one of those things like, man, it's like, it's the 10th round. I guess if he doesn't get hurt, he could, I don't know. He's just like a zero running back kind of candidate at that price. And I was kind of doing the halfway zero running back, taking Ekeler and then not much else. But I took, I got Terry McLaurin, I think, when I was hoping to get Amari Cooper in that 4th round. So that one jerk took Amari Cooper after me. I took Terry McLaurin. I think I got Curtis Samuel in the 9th round. And in both of my drafts, I took A.J. Dillon, I think, as my second running back, because he just seems underpriced on draft to me. Like, that's the one area where I think they are not very sharp in their current ADP, because the half point PPR bridges the gap a little bit between him and his normal competition just off the bat. Like, obviously his strength is not pass catching. So for the players ranked ahead of him who pass catching is a strength, the format necessarily brings them a little closer in the first place. And then the second thing is, A, like, he's going to be better than Jamal Williams and probably with a bigger role, and B, Aaron Jones is not a durable running back. Like, I think he's a great player, and I think he's definitely worth that contract that the Packers gave him, but he's almost like a running back receiver hybrid. And for the functions that he is a pure running back, he still doesn't do the same stuff that AJ Dillon will between the tackles. It's like all the fuss that people make about saying Jamal Williams is an A back and DeAndre Swift's a B back. Aaron Jones has been the B back all this time, and the A back role is there for Dillon, who's better than Williams. And in the event of an Aaron Jones injury, they just become the remaining guy just kind of takes on both at once, or maybe Kylan Hill will be the passing down guy. I don't know. But anyway, Aaron Jones gets hurt a lot. And I don't think, like, the way people reach for Kareem Hunt in the 4th round in every best ball draft, because, like, oh, well, if Nick Chubb gets hurt, Kareem Hunt's the running back one. AJ Dillon should benefit from a similar sort of upside logic, and people aren't applying it for some reason in this format. I'm going to keep hammering that as long as his price stays in that 8th to 9th round range.
Okay.
My bad. I was going tight end, Jonnu Smith in both drafts too. Sorry about that. He's just really cheap, I think, and that's why I went at the moment in both of those.
Got it. I see. And the AJ Dillon one, he's been a tough one for me to figure out because, you know, in Dynasty, we've both, you know, been big fans of his for a while, but I've really struggled with trying to figure out what his valuation is. So, I mean, over the last couple of years, like you said, Jones has gotten like all the production, but Williams has gotten a fair amount of snaps in that offense. So, you know, there is that role opening up where AJ Dillon is going to be on the field. I think probably a lot more than people are anticipating, even if Jones is still that number one guy. So, as far as like secondary options at the running back position, it doesn't get a whole lot better than AJ Dillon's projection right now. And again, it's just a matter of like figuring out where that valuation is relative to some of the rest of the running back pool. But, you know, the upside case for him is pretty massive, like you said.
Yeah. And people aren't appreciating the fact in the meantime that AJ Dillon is much better than Jamal Williams. I'm not saying he's as good or a little bit better. He's much better. He will have for that particular role in the offense, it will be a transforming nature to it going from Williams to Dillon. It's going to have a whole host of possibilities that it didn't before, and especially it's going to get better returns on the ground. AJ Dillon will do more with his carries than Jamal Williams ever did.
Absolutely. So, yeah, look forward to seeing AJ Dillon get unleashed in a more real serious way, as opposed to, you know, just him garbage time against the Titans like Christmas weekend last year. Like, let's see this consistently. Let's get this rolling. Because when we talked about when the Packers drafted AJ Dillon, is like, the perspective of tackling a 6 foot, 240 pound guy with, you know, 4.4 speed at Lambeau Field in December, that's not going to be very fun for defenses. So I'd love to just start getting that going. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a market inefficiency in the mere fact that people think Williams can do things that Dillon can, and it's just not true. So
that is patently false. Is there anything else that you wanted to add on to your best ball teams from Underdog, these first couple run throughs before we move on to some early receiver strategy?
Not really. I guess I'm still learning a lot about it. I guess we can use these misadventures of mine to hopefully get other people to do smarter things than me, or at least is what I've told them to get where they're trying to go. I've been tripped up a few times with all my planning. So maybe you just kind of have to not have one. Maybe you just have to hope you do the, you know, the Jedi sort of reactions and just have perfectly synchronized, like perfect insight and reflexes at the same time. And, you know, hopefully get that winning lotto ticket there.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's get on over to some early receiver strategy. So the way that I've structured things so far in a lot of my best ball drafts or in redrafts as well is I get running back a lot early. I almost always try to leave the first two rounds with two running backs, and I haven't had a lot of times where I've gotten a receiver in the first two rounds. We talked about the PPR draft last week, where, you know, I took Darren Waller with one of those selections in addition to Austin Eckler, and, you know, I'm admitting that that's not a foolproof strategy. I do feel like I'm more comfortable with attacking the mid rounds and finding the values in the mid rounds as far as the receivers go. And I just am a little bit risk averse to some of those running backs that go in a similar part of the draft. But even still, you know, I don't want to leave draft season with no Tyreek Hills, no Devontae Adams, no AJ Browns, that kind of thing. So I guess just walk us through, you know, the guys that you're targeting from those first two rounds and you know, kind of making some cases for taking them as high as they're going.
Yeah, so I've only done best ball drafts this far, and I can't claim to have very much thought out how I would maybe handle certain players differently in redraft season long. But for best ball, you know, a lot of my reception of these players and their prices has to do with how they fit into the pairing or the stacking potential. So I go into the third and fourth round range like I did in that Underdog draft. Not so much thinking, oh, I got to get CeeDee Lamb or I'm psyched to get Amari Cooper here, because I'm not really in either case. But if I can get both of them, then that gives a sort of like upside scenario with in the event of the Dallas passing game going off where it makes sense to target them there. So there's that kind of middle category of guys where I find them acceptable under certain conditions, but I'm not specifically trying to just load up on shares going into the season. The ones that I've so far identified as really good values to load up on, I guess, not that I'm totally certain about this. I mean, I'm not at all certain about it, but I feel like DJ Moore has to get more slot snaps this year for the Panthers with Curtis Samuel gone. And I think in that event, he will have the best intersection so far in his career of role and kind of preparedness and tasks that suit his nature as a player. Like, he's been good as a downfield outside receiver for the Panthers, but I think he can be a better one when you increase the percent of to which his outcomes are informed by his run after the catch. That should, if you raise that, I think you'll get better results out of him than leaving his outcomes subjected alternatively to air yardage and, you know, downfield passes landing on target. Because as much as I like Darnold, I'd rather just get the ball in DJ Moore's hand right away. And if he's playing in the slot, he's running more of those Curtis Samuel routes where he is getting the ball right away and some carries. Not that that matters, but it's like it can be an opportunity that he just didn't have last year. And if he gets it, I think he'll absolutely thrive with it, because I think it better suits his abilities. So I want to get more DJ Moore, at least at the current price. Like, if he starts pushing for the second round, I guess that's a little different. But so far, it seems like people are almost a little cooler on him than they were last year. And I don't understand how that can be the case when you're upgrading at quarterback and subtracting Curtis Samuel, who, you know, he wasn't playing the same role as Moore. He wasn't fighting for the same targets or tests, but whoever replaces Curtis Samuel won't be as good as him. They won't be able to draw as much usage as Samuel. So it almost necessarily leaves slack, and it could go to Robbie Anderson, but it seems like Robbie Anderson is of him and DJ Moore. Robbie Anderson seems the one who's more likely maxed out. So if there's a shifting slack and if someone can pick it up, I think it's got to be DJ Moore. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if he's kind of like a top 10 in PPR sort of receiver this year.
Yeah. I'd love to see that. Yeah, big DJ Moore fan, and yeah, I think that, yeah, the arrow trends up with Sam Darnold being in Carolina as opposed to the other way around. So maybe ADP will catch up to that soon enough. To me, it feels like, Mario, when you get past the first eight or so receivers and you get into the early third round, the next two guys that come up are generally Terry McLaurin and Allen Robinson as the next one's up. And, you know, in a lot of cases that could mean that McLaurin or Robinson are your first receivers on your given roster. How comfortable would you be with that type of setup where you've gone elsewhere with your first two picks and you're leaning on a guy like McLaurin or a guy like Allen Robinson to be the number one receiver on your team? Do you feel like that could give you enough production there? Is there reason to be a little bit concerned if like that's your loadout?
Well, it could be enough. I definitely buy the idea that Allen Robinson is good enough on his part. I mean, he's a total beast. He does have a little bit of an injury history. I don't know how much. I generally don't factor that into my process that much unless we got sort of like a developing chronic injury type with a player. As far as I know, Robinson just kind of gets nicked up from time to time, and he's had some bad luck in the past. So I'm not worried about him on those grounds. I am a little bit worried about the quarterback situation. I'm a little bit worried about the offensive line, but it's also just as much hard to imagine how it could be worse than it's been the past couple of years for Robinson to begin with. And he's obviously been very productive with the Bears. So that's one of those, he's one of those players who I think it's totally reasonable to take him where he's going. I'm probably not doing it as much as most people, and I may well get burned for it, but I find less reason for worrying generally with a guy like McLaurin, who he, like Robinson, has already shown the ability to produce despite poor quarterback play. But not just that, he's shown the ability to produce with quarterbacks who just do not suit his skill set, and especially his downfield abilities went to with Kyle Allen and Alex Smith throwing passes. So I don't think Fitzpatrick is good, and I don't think you need to believe Fitzpatrick is good to believe that he'll be a big upgrade for McLaurin, especially in that downfield element. So McLaurin's competent at all wide receiver tasks, including the underneath. He's pretty dangerous underneath and intermediate. But now that he has the down, if he has the downfield component going better than ever this year, then that's a new market in itself. But it also should make him even more effective underneath and in the intermediate, because he's going to get different kind of cushions, different kinds of coverages from defenses that will have to start accounting for his downfield ability. And so hopefully that can open him up, and hopefully Curtis Samuel, who's a great pairing target at a reasonable price so far. I feel like right now the market is inefficient with Curtis Samuel and Logan Thomas, respectively, having Samuel too low and Thomas too high. I think with Curtis Samuel there and even Diami Brown.
Looks like we might have a freeze on Mario's end. Again, we are talking about some early wide receiver strategy, specifically with the Washington football team right now, talking about Terry McLaurin and his fit in that offense, especially now with the football team's change at quarterback. And in addition to that, we also looking at the ADPs of players such as Curtis Samuel or Logan Thomas and how you want to approach them in their respective offense or in that respective offense and within your drafts as well. It looks like we might be unfortunately railroaded by some technical difficulties on this one. We are trying to get Mario back in the feed, but to recap from earlier in this week's episode, we took a look at AJ Brown and you know his recruitment of Julio Jones, what that might look like if Julio does end up as a trade candidate, specifically to Tennessee. We also took a look at the situation between Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers, of course. Taking a look, of course, as well at Mario's recent best ball drafts, taking a look at his recent strategies as far as that roster construction and the tough, sharp field that you seem to be going up against over at, if you're playing over at Underdog specifically, also getting into some wide receiver strategy, like we mentioned, talking about DJ Moore, talking about Curtis Samuel and other players, Terry McLaurin, of course, as well. I think we might be getting Mario back here to the stream. Mario, are you back?
Yeah, sorry. I guess my internet died. Sorry about that. Well, I don't know how far I got into it, but
filibustered.
The long and short of it is I tend to like McLaurin a little bit more generally than Robinson, and because I'm doing all best ball drafts right now, I'm also drawn toward McLaurin because I like the pairing potential of Samuel at his current price. So that's how I'm generally leaning at the moment.
Okay. All right. Very good. That sums it up there.
Thank you for filibustering.
You know, I find a way. So you know, got a little bit of experience doing that. You know, just with the way that the COVID year went, and having to like do some XM broadcasts that way, sometimes the connection drops out. So all good there. Let's get on over to a guy whose quarterback situation might be changing in a way that doesn't fit his skill set so perfectly. So Michael Thomas is someone who, you know, he couldn't have been a better fit for Drew Brees. I think that we can agree there. But with Drew Brees being gone, and you know, this kind of moves off of the discussion we had last week about Alvin Kamara and what direction that the quarterback change in New Orleans could impact on him. But when it comes to Michael Thomas, you know, it felt like he had such a, I don't want to say gimmicky role, but such a defined short yardage type of role, the type of thing that Drew Brees could hit reliably, and he couldn't really do much else back there at quarterback for the Saints late in his career. So with Brees being gone, how are you viewing Michael Thomas as a late third or early fourth type of target?
So I'm kind of anxious for the same reasons you said, and I'm probably lower on Michael Thomas as an overall talent than most people. I've always, even when he had his 200 catches or whatever it was 2 years ago, I was like, I don't think he's that good. But he is good, obviously. It's not that he's bad. It's like people were saying, oh, he's the best receiver in the league. And oh my God, is he as good as Megatron or whatever it was that all the stupid places offseason hype narratives go. And the whole time I was thinking like, this is irritating. He's not that good. He's just, you know, he's the latest Brees receiver. Brees makes receivers. It happens all the time. We saw him make Willie Snead had like 1,000 yards as a second year or first year player, undrafted out of Ball State, playing in Drew Brees' offense. And some of it probably has to do with Sean Payton, though, too, is the thing. And if so, that's encouraging for Thomas going forward, because if last year, granted, this was not a huge sample or anything, but when Taysom Hill played, Michael Thomas actually did well. And it was Alvin Kamara who lost all the pass catching work. So that's not to say Taysom Hill is good news for Michael Thomas. I wouldn't be surprised if some smoke and mirrors went into that outcome. But it show if it did, then it still shows all the same. Sean Payton can just kind of make this guy happen if he wants to. And he probably has to want to. It's all, what other choice does he have? Like Traquan Smith, the big new receiver in town? Probably not. So Thomas is probably good generally, almost definitely the best they have on the team. And if Sean Payton can kind of have this system product going, it's still going to be to Thomas's benefit. So it's kind of in that sense, like, who cares how good he actually is. So I do think that Jameis Winston would be better for Michael Thomas's interest, even if Jameis is more of like a downfield chucker. Michael Thomas might be able to do more downfield than he's done to this point. Like, he's been limited, but it's also been limited by design. And right. Maybe Winston dictates a little bit different design and maybe it works. I don't know. But I do want Jameis Winston. If I'm a Michael Thomas investor, I haven't had an opportunity where I really want to yet. I'm interested. I don't want to fade him entirely. But if I do invest in Michael Thomas, I'll be hoping for Jameis Winston just because of the pass attempt volume distinction. And, you know, Taysom Hill is going to run a lot more times than Jameis Winston. He's going to be generally worse with his passes than Winston, and he's going to run out the clock faster than Winston with all those carries. So I think Jameis Winston is clearly preferable for everybody else in that offense. Taysom Hill kind of is a parasite in the sense that, like, he becomes productive by drawing away usage from Kamara and the pass catchers.
Oh, okay. All right. That's a pretty good summation there. And you know, I think that most of the fantasy community would hope and expect that it's Jameis Winston, but you know, that this one could be a headache, and there's clearly an affinity down in New Orleans for Taysom Hill that's not shared by pretty much anybody online, from what I can tell.
He'd be a good receiver. Just move him to receiver. It's fine.
Yeah. See, there we go. One last guy that I wanted to talk to you about is Keenan Allen, because we saw the amazing target volume once again for him in, you know, a relatively shorter sample, you know, playing just 14 games last year, still drew 147 targets, which was just two fewer than his 2019 mark, where he played two more games. But there was a pretty sharp, pretty steep decline as far as that yards per target figure was concerned. And I was surprised to see that. And I actually was doing a best ball draft on DraftKings on Friday, and I kind of had to choose between Michael Thomas and Keenan Allen, and that yards per target mark dropping off that significantly kind of steered me away from him a little bit at his current ADP. It's something where I don't think that I will be fading Keenan Allen 100% by any means, but what do we make of that drop off where he had been reliably an 8 yards per target or better guy with really high volume to dropping down to 6.7 on such a high volume? What's sort of the interpretation there?
So I totally get the anxiety about that. And normally that's a bit of a red flag for me. And indeed, even in this case, I was kind of like you, I was like, oh my God, 6.7, what the hell? That's not so good. But just, this is maybe like kind of superstitious of me to use this sort of process. It's definitely not scientific, but from what I recall watching the Chargers and those Justin Herbert games, those first games of his, it felt like Keenan Allen was being effective. It just felt also like so much of the offense was built to where it's like Keenan would kind of have to do the volume stuff, which was both like the dirty work, the highest difficulty, because the defenses were sitting on him and Hunter Henry. If you look at Hunter Henry too, his efficiency really fell off last year with Justin Herbert. And I think part of that is, and yet their target volumes in both cases were high. So I guess what I read that as at the time, and putting it into the context of Herbert landing these long range shots over and over to Tyron Johnson and Jalen Guyton, and I assume Mike Williams got a few of those too. The whole offense was humming, even though Keenan Allen was struggling by the standard of yard per target. But I think that's just because he had the highest difficulty role in it. And you necessarily have to consider, you have to be like prepared to give his position, his role in that broader construction, to be allowed to go below the team efficiency baseline. Because basically, Keenan Allen had to suffer with that low efficiency for Tyron and Jalen Guyton and Mike Williams to keep getting open and single coverage downfield. And Herbert was landing those shots. So they you know, it's like maybe Keenan Allen's numbers was falling off at the time, but they scored a touchdown on those drives and no one really remembered. Like, when you watched the games, it didn't feel like Keenan Allen was struggling, even though his numbers said he was. So with Herbert scoring all those touchdowns, I feel like it's actually setting the floor pretty high for Keenan Allen. Not just because of, you know, the target volume is itself, you know, something to bet on. Like, that's 140. He had as many targets in 14 games basically as he did in 16 games in 2019. So right. That condition alone is kind of worth maybe it's not a reason to buy in more, but it's a reason to not be afraid of him, at least if you're getting points per receptions and half point PPR at least. So the way I see it is, because Herbert was scoring those touchdowns and because the offense itself, or the offense overall, was healthy, that means that there's adjustment room, because defenses are going to have to adjust more for those deep targets. They're going to have to say, look, we know that Keenan's a monster. We're going to try something with him too, but we got to stop putting the safeties up that far. They keep throwing it over our heads. So if because those touchdowns happen, I do think defenses have to approach it differently. And if they don't, then Herbert can, you know, barring some amount of regression or bad luck, he can keep making those long throws too. And if the Chargers are scoring a certain number of points per game, and if they're generating a certain amount of yardage per game, Keenan will necessarily get in on a lot of it. There's just no way for the first statement to be true unless Keenan Allen is doing a lot too. It's like the math just doesn't work. So I think that you can, it's right to be a little concerned. But after looking into it a little bit more, I feel like it's like a concerning sign, but a kind of thing that'll wash away in a bigger sample. So maybe I'm wrong, but I think because Herbert was actually doing well overall, it means defenses are going to have to try to stop them deep a little more than they thought they were. And Keenan has to get a little bit more room to hopefully catch more of those targets for more yards.
So today is the first time I've heard you mention this, even, you know, just as like almost like a side comment, but it's something that I've also started to see a little bit more when it comes to the discussion around Justin Herbert and the word regression. I feel like I've started to see that creep in a little bit, and it's, I don't know where it's, I mean, I guess I know where it's coming from, and it's not completely uncommon or unheard of for a quarterback to start out hot and then the next season, you know, have that, you know, proverbial sophomore slump. But am I just like putting two things together here, or is there kind of a growing rationale as to why, you know, Herbert is kind of now almost being labeled as a regression candidate, or am I off on that?
Well, I think it's a concern you have to address with pretty much any player who's coming off one of the strongest seasons of their careers. Like, you have to, as a constant policy, be on the lookout for it. So I definitely understand why people look at Herbert and having 37 touchdowns or whatever it was on not that many pass attempts. It's just objectively true that it's very uncommon for quarterbacks to have touchdown percentages like that over broader samples. There are some players who can prove an exception, like Lamar, and I'm assuming Mahomes and Rodgers and guys like that. But until they reach that superstar sort of level, it's always unlikely that they can keep it up, you know? So it's kind of, I guess to me, the way you look at it comes down to how you answer the question of, like, is Herbert a legitimate star quarterback? And I was not especially high on him necessarily. I feel like I couldn't really figure him out as a prospect coming in. I was like, you know, I didn't really like his tape that much. The production isn't that great, but he is huge and can really run, and he has this strong arm. And I looked at Josh Allen and thought, like, well, it seems to be working for him, and he had a lot of the objectively same indicators coming in. So I refused to like condemn Herbert as a prospect, but also stick my neck out to try to, you know, vouch for him. So I have no particular vanity reason to say, yes, he is a star, but I feel like it's more likely than the alternative, or at least, you know, he should be very good and never drift below that. Like, even if he's not going to be a top five quarterback, I don't think he's going to have a particularly difficult time, because each way the defense tries to adjust to him, like I was saying before, it's like if they try to put their safeties back to stop that deep ball, and if people are saying, you know, he's dependent on the deep ball, he wasn't very effective throwing to Keenan Allen and Hunter Henry. So if Tyron Johnson doesn't average 20 yards a catch, and if Jalen Guyton doesn't average 20 yards a catch, his numbers are going to regress, and he's going to have fewer of these, you know, long bomb touchdowns. And that all would be true. But even if it is, there still might be a gain around Keenan Allen. And I won't say Jared Cook, but I guess he's going to be running around in that region, so maybe. or at least it's safe to say Jared Cook does not need to do very well this year to match or exceed the efficiency of Hunter Henry last year. So I feel like the means by which Justin Herbert is most likely to regress, which is defenses sitting on this so-called, you know, bailout, or, you know, ace in the hole that he had going deep all the time to offset his inefficiencies elsewhere, that will concede better efficiency from the part where he was inefficient before. And I think when you have the sum of production that you do with Herbert and the Chargers offense, the defense can try to cut off some of it by adjusting their strategy. but the sum is so much that you're always leaving yourself vulnerable somewhere else. There's not a way to truly stop the bleeding unless Herbert both regresses as a downfield passer and does not improve with this increase in underneath space. So I'm a little skeptical that that will happen. I'm skeptical that he won't improve in some way. I feel like he can adjust, especially when Keenan Allen is so good in that part of the field. It's like, it's a bad idea to bet on Keenan Allen being that inefficient in general, but especially if you know the condition that the safeties will be further away. Like that's just about as bad of a bet as you can think of.
Okay. I mean, yeah, this is, again, is something that just kind of has popped up, and I've seen it attached to Justin Herbert more now. And maybe we're just like reaching that part of May where we got to start like getting our takes ready. And you know,
it's a good general process. I just think it's in this particular case, it's like Herbert is the exception you're otherwise like suspicious of. It's like, exceptions are rare, but here is one.
Yeah, like if I thought that Justin Herbert stunk, and you know, I will hand up say that like I was surprised by how good he was last year based on my expectations coming into his rookie season. But that makes me more inclined for the way that he performed to just think, okay, he is going to be a good NFL quarterback, as opposed to the, you know, the converse of that with him, you know, regressing into being this like middling mediocre player, because he has tools that I think are exceptional. I think he has, you know, what it takes between the ears, in addition to being a big dude with a really strong arm, and plus athleticism to tack onto it. Yeah. So I think he's got everything to be, you know, maybe not win it all. I mean, and having Patrick Mahomes in that division is tough, but man, for fantasy purposes, at the very least, at least for 2021, I don't see things like falling off to where I would be concerned about taking him.
He's not expensive. You're not paying the ceiling price for Herbert right now. You're not, you don't have to draft him as high as Lamar, Dak, or Kyler Murray. Like, he seems to pretty consistently go the latest of those four. So I actually, you know, I go into it kind of agnostic or whatever. I'm not really committed either way. But when I look at the price of Herbert right now, it's pretty easy. It's pretty easy for me to say, oh yeah, well, in that case, I'm totally comfortable with it.
There we have it. All right, Mario, that's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of the RotoWire NFL podcast, brought to you by our friends over at WinBet. We will be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Try RotoWire today, free for 10 days. Get our premium tools, rankings, analysis, and breaking news alerts. No credit card required. Go to rotowire.com/try.